Hello and welcome back to Tales from Wisteria Lane, the podcast where we give you a fair view of all things Desperate Housewives. I'm Joel.
I'm Billy Ray.
And today we will be discussing Season 6, Episode 11, If.
Yes, and what an emotional roller coaster that we've got ahead of us today.
It really was. I watched it first thing in the morning a couple of days ago and I was crying.
I feel you, but I'll get into why later.
Yeah, it's a very interesting episode. I really like it. I think it's a standout episode.
Yeah, I do like the what-if scenarios in TV and film because the writers get to be really creative and they can explore avenues without it having to be canon.
Yeah, exactly. So I will be doing the overview this week and B will be doing the trivia. So do you have anything to start us off?
I do. I've got loads.
Oh, good.
So this originally aired on the 3rd of January 2010. So it's the first episode of the 2010s. This was written by Jamie Gorenberg and directed by Larry Shaw. Unfortunately, I couldn't find what exactly the song was from, as in the episode title this came from, but we can assume that it's any Stephen Sondheim song with the word if in it.
That's true, actually, because I guess sometimes it doesn't tell me when I'm doing the research either, or like I can't find it, so I do just have to type in Stephen Sondheim and then the episode title, and it will normally bring up the song. But if you just type in Stephen Sondheim if...
I did, and I didn't find a song called If.
No, so...
So it must have been in a song.
Yeah.
So, on this week, from Monday the 28th of December 2009 to Sunday the 3rd of January 2010, the number one song in the US was TikTok by Kesha, and the number one song in the UK was The Climb by X Factor winner Joe McElderry.
Right. It's a... No offense, Joe McElderry, like, you won X Factor, congratulations and all that, but if it's not Miley Cyrus...
He was very good, and it was a cover of the Miley Cyrus song, which everyone knows and loves.
Which also makes zero sense, because the point is that X Factor UK coincided with Christmas, so that it ended up, hopefully, being a satisfactory contender for Christmas number one. Miley Cyrus's The Climb doesn't constitute a Christmas number one.
No, but it constitutes a winning X Factor song. It's like,
it
I did
does.
It, I
did it, I climbed the mountain, I can almost see it, that dream I'm dreaming.
The picture used for this episode on IMDb at time of recording is old Gabby in the terrible grey wig from her part of the episode, just thought I'd point that out.
That's so rude.
The episode attracted 15.35 million viewers and scored a 5.3 out of 13 in the 18 to 49 demographic, a season high and the highest rating for this show since 2008, since the episode of season 5, A Vision's Just a Vision.
Oh.
This episode confirms that the disaster and events that led to and from the disaster killed 5 people in total.
Yeah.
With the Bixes being 2 of them, if you count Jeff's heart attack, which I do. Carl, Mona, and tragically, one of Lynette's unborn babies.
Yeah, which we will get to.
The Scarvo's son being named Patrick goes with the naming trend of Lynette's family, where each kid's name starts with a P. On a side note, each of Lynette's siblings has a name that starts with an L.
She does, yeah.
This is the first time in 3 seasons that an episode of Desperate Housewives placed number 1 in the rank of the most watched series of the week. The last time that happened was in season 3 with The Miracle Song.
Damn, people were really enjoying season 6.
People were enjoying this episode a lot.
Yeah.
And then we've got a goof slash continuity error. So when Carl went out of Susan's house during the what if scenario and turned to face her in the doorway, behind his back, Karen McCluskey's new house is visible, although it was 2003, 4 years before the tornado.
Oh, yeah, well, they're not going to build back Karen's old house just for that one shot.
No, of course not. So, 11-year-old Celia in this episode is played by Carolina Villarreal. I'm really sorry if I mispronounced that, Carolina. She hasn't been in much, but is apparently known for Valentine's Day in 2010, Border Town in 2007, and obviously Desperate Housewives. Adult Celia is played by Gloria Garayua. I'm really sorry if I mispronounced that, Gloria. She was born on the 18th of October, 78, in the Bronx, New York City. She's an actress and producer known for Maid, 2021, Reckoning in 2019, and Grey's Anatomy in 2005. She graduated summa cum laude from Long Island University. She's an intermediate classical pianist and is a member of the Latina-based organization Hermandad de Sigma Lota Alpha Incorporada, which apparently is a national sorority recognized by NALFO, which itself is the National Association of Latino Fraternal Organizations Incorporated.
I think it's pronounced cum laude.
Maybe.
I think.
So those are the Celias of the episode.
Yeah.
12-year-old Patrick, who is Lynette's unborn child. He's played by Zane Emery. And Zane Emery was born in McMinnville, Oregon, and began acting at an early age, pursuing a career in local theater. He's been in TV shows such as Shameless and The Goldbergs, the 24 reboot 24 Legacy, Marvel's Runaways, and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And adult Patrick is played by Anthony Trainer. Anthony moved to Los Angeles in 2007. He's been a performer his whole life, and apparently acting in film is his number one goal. He's known for TV shows such as Bass Reeves and Shameless, but I didn't see any films yet.
Oh, that's a shame.
So those were the special guest stars that we had in this episode, and that's all the trivia that I have.
Okay, well then let us get on with the episode. That was some good trivia, babe.
Thank you.
So, previously on Desperate Housewives, tragedy hit the lane when a plane carrying a banner that Carl was using to propose to Brie crashed during their annual Christmas party. So even with all of their bad blood, Lynette saved Celia from being hit by the plane. Mona found out about Angie's past and blackmailed her until the plane hit Mona, saving Angie's bank account. Carl told Orson the truth about him and Brie. A fight broke out between them, both in Santa's workshop, but the plane slammed right into it, leaving us wondering who survived, if any of them. And with Mike in prison for stabbing Catherine, Susan resorts to calling Dylan in the hopes of getting Catherine committed, and with their lies catching up to her, Catherine breaks down in the hospital.
Yeah, but luckily for her, she misses all this drama.
Yeah, both Catherine and Susan missed the plane incident. So fortunately for me, when it came to note-taking, this episode is fairly linear.
Yep, super easy.
Really easy note-taking. So I've just started with the opening where all of them are talking and then I just hit each one. So we open with news reporters everywhere and Mary Alice telling us that we don't know who survived the accident. And then we cut to the hospital where a confused Susan comes back after just leaving to get the gossip. And we're told that Carl is currently in surgery, but there was a lot of bleeding and we don't know if he's going to survive. Orson and Mona are also in surgery and Brie was apparently banged up, but she'll be fine and Celia has a concussion. And then Carlos thanks Lynette for saving his daughter's life, telling her that they owe her everything, which I guess is sort of like a bridge to fixing their friendship.
Can we also talk about how funny it is that all these people are in surgery and little Celia might have a concussion?
Yeah, right. Well, Celia wasn't hit or anything.
I know. It was just really funny the way it was brought up. And little Celia might have a concussion.
Well, they're just
like, everyone else has got like surgery and stuff.
Well, they're just listing off the issues. Even Brie was fine. She didn't need surgery or anything. She was just banged up a bit.
Yeah, a bit banged up.
Yeah. Now all the surviving cast can do is wait and pray. Lynette then suddenly gets a pain in her stomach and then panic ensues as she believes something's wrong with the babies. And then we just sort of hit all of the characters one by one. So let's start with Angie, because she's got like the smallest one, I'd say.
Couldn't just do it in order, it had to be difficult.
I know. So, Angie and Nick are impatiently waiting to hear about Mona and shocked that she survived the surgery, and we have a clip.
Can you tell me anything about Mona Clark's condition? The doctors, they did everything they could, but that woman, I mean, she was hit by a plane.
Oh my God.
Now all we can do is wait and hope that she pulls through.
Pulls through?
Yes, your friend's a real fighter. She's hanging in there.
How? She got hit by a plane.
The doctors couldn't believe it either. I don't know if you're religious, but now would be the time to pray.
Oh, believe me, we will. Dear God, please take that blackmailing bitch home now.
A freaking plane hit her. What's it gonna take? A silver bullet?
I mean, naturally, you must think, that's a godsend. This woman was blackmailing me, she was gonna ruin my life, and then a plane just comes out of nowhere and hits her.
Right, Angie said, like, I caused an explosion, killed a man, but God's still on my side.
Yeah, that's a godsend. And then she's like, what do you mean she's gonna pull through, possibly? What the fuck?
So, Nick goes home to pack, and Angie stays at the hospital to keep an eye on the situation, and whilst waiting, she thinks about what would have happened if Mona does live. And then we flash forward and Angie has been arrested and stuck in an interview room and she wants to see Nick and Danny, but apparently Nick's been branded a traitor by the police.
Yeah, that was interesting.
So,
I wonder what that means.
Assuming that Nick was working with the police?
I'm not sure. It's just a little hint of storyline.
Yeah. So Angie is apparently never going to see him again and Tyler is with her mother.
Is this where we find out that she becomes an extra in Orange is the New Black?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the interviewer tells Angie that they need to know where Logan is because they know he ran everything, but if he isn't found, it will all fall on her. But apparently she's claiming that she hasn't spoken to him since that night, and she tells the police that they were not the ones that she was running from, but her former lover, Logan.
Yeah, who's Patrick Logan? Why is he so scary?
Yeah.
I mean, we find out that he's obviously the boss of their terrorist organization. We hear that.
Yeah.
She says that he headed everything. So they're really building up this character, giving us a little bit more backstory as to what she's running from.
Because
apparently it wasn't just her crimes and her guilt.
No, and we'll hear about more from Patrick Logan soon, but honestly, I can't wait for it.
Yeah, because you watch this and it's like, well, now I really want to meet him. Apparently he's really scary. Everyone's running from him.
Yeah. So we then cut to the trial and Angie gets a chance to say her piece before she's sentenced, and she addresses the wife and child of the man she killed, and she sort of apologizes. She doesn't actually say I'm sorry, but I guess the sentiment was there. And then she is sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. Oh, voice just went then, guys. Sorry. She gets taken away, and Danny does his really bad acting.
Danny's acting. I wrote Angie's acting in the courtroom is in her best.
Really? I thought Danny's was terrible. When Angie gets taken away and Danny's just there like, Mom!
He was all right. He's young. But Angie was really playing up the dramatics. It was almost camp.
Well, yeah, because she's trying to like tug at the heartstrings. I'd be doing more.
I mean, don't get me wrong.
I'd be doing more.
I did love it.
Come on, Angie. Where's the tears? Shed that single tiny tear. Let that jury know.
I let it slip, though, because it's a what-if scenario. So she's probably just living her telenovela life in her head.
Yeah. So if Mona lives, we've established that Angie is going to go to prison for life.
Possibly. It's a what-if scenario. It's her imagination.
That's true.
That might not even happen if Mona lived.
But we cut back to the present day and the nurse tells Angie that Mona died. And then she says, please don't be angry with God because your prayers weren't answered. Girl.
Like, why are you gatekeeping God and how people should feel with their emotions?
Right, girl. What happened to separation of church and state? Okay, I don't need you preaching to me right now in the hospital. You believe what you want to believe. You'll let me believe what I want to believe. But me and God are good, okay?
But also, don't be angry with God about this. I'll be angry with God about whatever I want.
Yeah. So that's Angie's story. Quite small. But we do get a little bit more information on the whole mystery.
Yeah, and we get a nice little reset for Angie.
Yes.
She doesn't have to worry about that damn blackmailer anymore.
So, we'll do Gabby now, who has a fun one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's sad, but it's fun. So, Gabby and Carlos are watching over Celia, who's being kept overnight as a precaution. Carlos believes they're lucky, but Gabby has clearly lost her mind because she believes God saved Celia because she's special and she has a gift.
Yeah.
And so Gabby then begins to think of what Celia's gift could be, ticking off the various skills and interests that apparently she's seen Celia struggle with so far over the years. And as she falls asleep, she thinks about, you know, what if her daughter was meant to be an actress?
Yeah, Celia's a strange child. I mean, eating the clay, that was a bit much.
Yeah, that was a bit odd.
Yeah, I should really get you checked for something.
I should really get you tested.
That was it. I should get you tested. Maybe.
So we flash forward to Celia, who is 5, at her first audition for an advert, but she doesn't seem to be sort of getting it. The auditioner doesn't believe she's as talented as Coleslaw, apparently, but Gabby snaps at him and tells him that she's special, so he caves in very easily, I might add.
This poor guy, he probably gets shouted out by stage moms constantly.
Exactly. You cannot convince me that Gabby is the first parent to snap at him like that about their kid. And if he gives in to all the stage moms like that, he'll be there all night.
Yeah.
So she talks to Celia and she tries everything she can think of to get her to cry. But it's the death of a hamster that finally gets her. And success, we have a crying child.
She even pretends that Carlos has been hurt.
Yeah, it was only the whole, oh, Carlos is injured. And he fell on your hamster that got her. She really doesn't care about her dad.
We should get you tested.
Yep. Right. So we flash forward again to an older Carlos and Celia. And our Carlos is a very attractive man here. I would say that too. He looks even better. Like, this man is a fine wine. He ages well.
Oh, yeah. He looks really hot as an older man. That salt and pepper hair really suits him.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Yeah. I mean, salt and pepper hair does look good on a lot of people, just saying.
Well, yeah.
So he's escaping with Celia to get some ice cream, apparently. But Gabby questions why they need bags. And then they run to the car to get Celia off to camp before Gabby stops them. They drop things, and in their flustering, they do fail to escape.
She also doesn't like she's aged a day.
No, I know, not at all.
No, Carlos has aged, probably because of Gabby.
Probably because, yeah, I was literally about to say, because of Gabby, Carlos has aged.
Yeah.
So Gabby and Carlos argue. Carlos believes Celia sucks at acting and she deserves a normal childhood. And Gabby's still holding on to the fact that God saved her for a reason. And she doesn't believe God would save someone just for them to have a normal life. And then Carlos tells Gabby he won't watch her ruin his daughter's childhood. So she tells Carlos to leave then. And he does.
Yeah, that was rough.
That was rough.
girl, what is happening?
She's, I don't know, she's become like the stage mum of all stage mums. She's the queen of stage mums.
She's seen God, she knows God's message, and she's going to roll with that.
Yeah. We flash forward again, and unlike Carlos, they've not allowed Gabby to age well. Nor the house, frankly, I will say, because it honestly looks like Gabby and Celia are squatters.
Yeah, they really are ramping up the what-if scenario here, because this is ridiculous. What has happened?
Gabby has lost Carlos. Her skin has sagged to, like, a billionth degree, and it honestly looks like they live in a crackdown. They've not taken care of this house at all.
Well, there's a difference between not taking care of a house and the house becoming dilapidated.
Yeah.
And what is with this awful wig?
Oh, yeah, the wig. That grey wig was bad, Gabby.
Yeah, which is the IMDb picture for this episode.
Yeah.
I mean, her imagination's running fucking wild here. Like,
We're in the trenches.
We're in the wild west of imaginations right here, guys.
Like we've said, Gabby's old and grey, and she's drinking wine whilst watching Celia's old advert. And that's when Celia comes home with the shopping, and then Gabby gets a call from Celia's agent. Gabby lies and tells him that Celia can pass for 15.
Nope.
Which is absolutely not true when she's 30, according to the IMDb.
To be honest, though, TV shows these days would make me believe that.
Yeah. So she then runs around to try and get her prepared, and then Celia chimes up to tell Gabby that she doesn't want to be an actress. But Gabby shuts that thought down by telling her that she's lost everything to try and get her to be a star, and she isn't quitting now. Because yeah. She even states in this episode has been completely devoid of Juanita, except for one shot at the beginning when Juanita's in her dad's arms. And all they've got to say about it is Gabby mentioning in this final scene, your sister doesn't call.
I wonder
your dad's
why.
Left. I was like, yeah, exactly. Like, why does Celia not call? Probably because you've neglected her as a child and put all of your emphasis onto Celia. Maybe Juanita was a good actress, but you just failed to cultivate that.
Yeah.
From this, Gabby wakes up from that horrible nightmare, and Carlos enters asking her if she's figured out what Celia's gift is, but Gabby now knows that she doesn't need a gift to be special. She already is.
Yeah, that was a very cute outcome from that whole horrifying dream sequence. Well,
I think Gabby would have continued if it wasn't for that final dream scene where she saw herself as old grey and unable to get her wrinkle groom.
Yeah,
she woke up from that like, in a sweat, all horrible.
The wig, it was horrible.
Oh my god.
A cute little smiling Celia in bed as well.
Yeah.
Adorable.
So, we'll do Susan next. So Karen comes to check on Susan, telling her that after he cheated on her, she hated him and never spoke to him again, yet here she is praying for his survival, so she feels like a bit of a hypocrite.
I love that, though. Bit of friend solidarity there.
Yeah. Even though we don't really see Karen and Susan as, like, a duo that much.
No, not really.
But it's nice that Karen is here for all the ladies. Like, obviously, predominantly, we see her with Lynette. We have historically seen her with Lynette, and that's kind of continued.
Yeah. I mean, as we know, things happen off camera constantly.
Yeah. And Susan agrees and begins to ponder on her marriage and what would have happened if they never broke up. And we have our first flashback what-if moment of the actual episode. Obviously, we've not done it in that order. Susan tells Carl not to leave because they have a daughter and they owe it to her. And she demands to know every other woman that he's cheated on her with. So he starts to list them all.
Is that everyone? I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, we'll be here a while, Susan.
What a pig.
Susan can't take it anymore, and she stops him and tells him that she'll learn to swallow her rage, and she turns to the nearest cookie for comfort.
I love that in this moment as well, they've given them darker hair to make them look younger.
Oh, yeah. Good spot.
Both their hairs were darker.
Yeah. One of Carl's stories does sound like a porn storyline as well, I will say. He was like, oh, yeah, do you know when we got all those extra free channels for cable? I was like, that's a porn storyline, Carl.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that even happened.
Yeah. So we then cut to sometime later, and we get Fat Susan, which I will use of air quotes. It's that same sort of weird feeling that you see now when you look back on old episodes of Friends and they have the flashback scene of Rachel and Monica.
Yeah, Fat Monica.
Fat Monica.
Yeah, they're doing the whole, this character was fat in this storyline for humour, and
yeah.
It's not great.
No, it's not great. Fortunately, I think this is the only time we ever see it in the show.
And it's very brief, it's just Susan's imagination, so I'll begrudgingly let it slide.
Yeah, and we see Mike turning up to Susan's to fix her drain. So at this point, this scene is set shortly after the very first episode of Desperate Housewives. So shortly after Mary Alice's funeral, where Susan met Mike. But obviously, Susan is now still married to Carl, So wasn't interested in going after him. So they're making meaningless small talk, and that's when Carl calls and tells Susan that he's going to be working late. So Susan sits down and just like opens up to Mike about how she knows that Carl is screwing his secretary, and she then tries to make a pass at Mike, who isn't very interested and accidentally implies Susan's fat. And then he leaves telling her that she should do something about it if she's unhappy. And that is the reason we have Fat Susan.
She also sexually harasses Mike for a laugh.
She does sexually harass Mike
for
a laugh.
Even though he said no and that he wasn't interested, she still goes in for a kiss.
She still goes in for a kiss while he's under the sink.
No, thank you.
But let's also just be clear, we only have Fat Susan for that Mike moment.
Yeah.
Where he goes, I think you're very desirable in a big way. But that's literally the only reason we have that Fat Susan scene, so that Mike can make that comment and Susan goes, did you just call me fat?
And also so that he can turn her down, because I don't know, Mike isn't attracted to her in this universe.
No.
Also, I just want to point out that she looks horrified when she sees her distorted reflection in the toaster, which makes her look even comically larger. But in real life, that's kind of what it feels like when you're overweight and self-conscious and you look at yourself every day. And I thought it was a really nice, it was a cool addition in a way.
Yeah, but also looking at your reflection in a toaster is like looking at a reflection of yourself in a funhouse mirror.
Yeah.
Like, look at yourself in a proper mirror. Don't rely on a toaster. That ain't going to reflect back the right thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's comedic here, but... Like, for if you have body dysmorphia, or if you're just even self-conscious looking at yourself in the reflection, it's kind of what it's like.
Yeah. So we cut to our almost usual Susan, who is working out, and she sees Carl's packed his bags and is leaving her. And this
Did you say usual Susan, because she still does look a little bigger somehow?
Almost usual, yeah.
In some places.
It's the chin.
I noticed
like
that too.
The neck. So Susan snaps at Carl, saying it's been 4 years since Susan stopped Carl from leaving, and she's absolutely devoed after all this time that he is now leaving her. And he claims that she could have spared herself the pain if she let him leave 4 years ago. And she looks across the street to see Mike with some pregnant rando. Mm. So she's basically lost her chance to get with the love of her life now.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And we cut back to present day, and a handsome, clearly tired surgeon tells Susan that Carl didn't make it. And then Karen turns to Susan and says, I can't imagine what you're feeling. And then Susan tells Karen that she feels grateful.
Yeah, it didn't sound great, Susan.
No.
There was no context. And she just goes, honestly, I'm feeling grateful.
Thank God he's dead.
Susan.
Yeah.
No one knows what you've just been thinking about.
No.
You just sound horrible now.
Karen's just there like, all right, bitch.
Jeez. Should have saved my prayers for something else.
Show some respect, Susan. The man's dead.
Yeah.
So as it should naturally feel, we move on to Bree. So Bree was told about Carl's death and apparently became so hysterical that she had to be sedated. She begins to dream about what her life would have been like if she had married Carl. We cut to after Bree and Carl's wedding, and they're both incredibly happy and horny, and Carl tells Bree that he meant what he said about being with her, making him into a new man. Although Bree hopes not too new, she doesn't want him to lose that sort of sexy charm, dirty grunginess that he's got.
But she still wants to have sex in a very polite, conservative way.
Yeah.
She's like, please unzip me with your teeth and do me on the table. In that Brie voice that she has.
Yeah.
I was like, oh God.
Very weird.
Brie.
So we then cut to Carl finishing up with sex, and Brie walks into the room to find that Carl is cheating on her, and we have a clip.
Wow, honey, that was fantastic. Brie!
Oh my God.
You're supposed to be catering a wedding.
Yes, clearly this is my fault. Courtney?
I'm so sorry, Brie.
Really, Carl, my yoga instructor?
No charge for next month, okay?
Like I'm keeping you? Get the hell out of my house.
She's going.
I'm not talking to her.
No charge for next month. What the fuck, Courtney?
Girl, you're doing this for free from now on. Who are you kidding?
Next month. That's all she has to say. What a bitch. She rocks up and she's like, I'm so sorry, Brie. Like, what the fuck are you?
I love how at the start of this scene, she keeps her face completely hidden behind the pillow for a second when Brie walks in.
Mm-mm.
I guess just for a second, we're watching it. We're like, oh my God, who is it then?
Yeah.
But it's hilarious because she's just laying there like a plank of wood behind the pillow.
Yeah, I know. And to be fair, she's probably laying there thinking like, oh my God, what do? How do I get out of this? It's Brie. I can't get out of this. And then she just resigns herself to sitting up because she's like, there's literally nothing else I can do. So yeah, here we go. Leopards never change their spots and all that.
Yeah.
So Courtney is her yoga instructor, who's incredibly sorry, but Brie kicks them both out. And then Carl follows Brie downstairs to tell her that she knew what she was getting into when they got married and she can never change him. And then he mentions Orson and how she did this exact thing to him. And then she tells him to leave and storms upstairs.
Yeah, going back into that whole guilt complex for Brie that keeps coming up, which is fair. She is cheating.
Yeah, and she's obviously, you know, conservative, religious.
annoying.
The very thing is guilt, let's face it.
Yeah, it's part of who they are.
And Carl is notoriously like this. We've seen it time and time and again from Carl when he is finding himself in a corner and he is the one that's put himself in that corner. He's never going to accept responsibility for that and he will divert it onto someone else. So what he's done here is essentially say to Bree, I've not done a thing you didn't do, so don't you feel bad. Like, don't you make me feel bad about this whole thing because you did the exact same thing to Orson.
Yeah, he'll smugly defend himself into a corner.
Yeah. We cut to nearly 10 years after Bree finds Carl cheating on her.
Oh god, this scene.
Yeah, I know. And Bree is at a dingy flat, which is apparently, or was apparently, Orson's place, and the landlord called Bree as she was Orson's emergency contact still. Yeah. Bree is surprised as they haven't spoke since they split, and then the landlady tells Bree that he didn't have any friends or family, no one ever came to visit him. It's like the saddest thing ever. It's like It's a Wonderful Life but for desperate housewives.
Yeah.
He apparently died of a heart attack and he wasn't found for 2 days, so Bree, as his emergency contact, is allowed to just take what she wants, and as she's looking around, she sees old photos of her and Orson on the table, and apparently Orson spoke about Bree constantly, and then we get the cheesiest line that is ever uttered in the show, and possibly in the history of writing for television.
The overdramatic telenovela scene, seriously.
It's almost like,
what?
He died of a broken heart.
She's like, it's like he died of, and Bree goes, what?
Say it. It's so, like, the pause, the Bree jumping in to be like, I know what you're gonna say, just say it.
It's like he died of a broken heart. Desperate Housewives, give me a fucking break.
Don't cry for me, I'm already dead.
I could have cried with laughter at this moment.
I did.
It's like they're doing so much comedy and stupid stuff to set up Lynette's tragic story, but honestly.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my god, but the way that Bree this isn't even real, this is just Bree's imagination. But she imagines that Orson lived in some shitty flat, not well kept and scummy looking. He had no friends or family, he never moved on, and he kept a shrine of all these photos. It's like, there's no humbling Bree.
No, I know. She's literally there like, even in the alternate reality, other universe, Orson's still just so obsessed with me.
She could have imagined anything. And she's like, he never moves on from me. I'm all he has. Oh my god.
So we then cut to present day, and the surgeon / doctor wakes Bree up to tell her that Orson is alive and recovering, but possibly paralysed.
Yeah, and
from the waist down.
I wanted him to get comeuppance following everything that he's done, but I only meant for Bree to leave him, not this.
Yeah, I know. We didn't want him being, like, confined to a chair all his life.
Like, jeez.
Right? Guys. Is he going to get the Carlos treatment?
Oh, what, were they like, where he's, oh, like, we found a piece of shrapnel on your leg. Once we remove it, you can walk again.
Yeah.
Because like, the writer's like, Kyle McLaughlin doesn't want to be in a chair anymore. How can we write him out of it?
Yeah, I know. Oh, we're really fed up of this whole, like, blind guide dog not enjoying Gabby storyline. Let's get Carlos's sight back.
Yeah.
Finally, we move on to the final story of the episode, which is the most heartbreaking one.
Yeah, I remember we first watched this and I cried.
Yeah, I know.
And I cried again watching this the other day. This one just hits me in a very close to home way that really gets me apparently every time I'm going to watch it, because it just reminds me of some stuff that happened in my life.
Timing probably hasn't helped as well.
Yeah. And it's just so, so sad.
It is really sad. Really beautiful. It is a really beautiful sort of story for Lynette, but it is very... It's sad. So Lynette's been checked over by a doctor, and apparently there's been a tear to her placenta brought on from when she fell after saving Celia. One baby is fine, but they need to operate on the other now to avoid complications going forward. They take Lynette into surgery, and she begins thinking about her baby and what it would be like to hold him, and then she thinks about what it would be like if the child were disabled.
Yeah, because they say that it would have led to a decreased blood flow to the brain.
Yes.
Which basically means that he'd have some learning disabilities.
Some disabilities, yeah. So we flash forward to Lynette going through physical therapy with her child, and she's struggling because it's clear the baby doesn't like it and won't stop crying. But Tom is at least putting on a braver face. The therapist calls for a break and they discuss currently where they're at, but all Lynette seems to be able to do is focus on the fact that other kids around his age are doing so much more than he is, but the therapist tells her that she needs to stop thinking like that because it will drive her crazy.
Yeah, she's very good like that. She was very patient.
What, the therapist?
Yeah.
Which probably sees it a lot.
I think it's a good lesson for all parents as well, that comparing the milestones of your children to others isn't really a very constructive way to live.
Like, disabled or not, like, you should never really be comparing your child to anyone else's child. Each child, each person is different and they will hit milestones at different points. But just because your friend's baby learned to walk X amount of time quicker than your baby doesn't mean that that baby's any better than yours or what have you. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong.
Yeah, but clearly this is very hard for Lynette.
Yeah.
She can't take all the crying.
No, well, no, it is tough. It was tough to watch. And even I was watching it like, oh my God, I'm uncomfortable. Like, the baby doesn't like it. But obviously the therapist is right. We do it so that he can get stronger.
Yeah. But Tom's so strong. Tom's so good.
It was. I know. In this timeline, we love Tom.
Yep.
So Lynette walks off and tells Tom she can't do it. It's too hard. And she feels like she's being punished, but she doesn't know why. And the fact that their son might not even have a future. But Tom tells Lynette not to write him off so soon and gives her a pep talk. And she goes to the baby and continues where she left off.
Mm.
And she's there like pulling on the baby's, not pulling on the baby's leg, but doing, you know what I mean? Doing the physical therapy stretches.
Yeah, doing hamstring exercises with the legs.
And like looking at the baby going, I can do this.
Yeah.
Again, we flash forward several years, a decade maybe, I'd say. And their son is all grown up. Well, not all grown up. He's like a young teenager, I'd say.
Yeah, he is 12.
Oh, okay. So probably more than 10 years, I'd say. He wants a sandwich, but he doesn't want to wait for Lynette to finish doing the dishes. So Lynette tells him either to shut up and wait or make it himself. Nice to know her parenting style doesn't change. And then he goes on to say that his friend's mum makes his friend all the kinds of food he wants whenever he asks for even French toast.
Mm.
Patrick gives Lynette a really evil look when she's like, shut up and wait or do it yourself. Hilarious. And then Lynette decides to push him to make it himself because she won't always be here to make him sandwiches and he needs to learn to do it.
Yep, that was really hard.
Really tough scene to watch. Like, Patrick seems to be conditioned to think everyone around him will do everything, which I think Lynette has noticed. And so she does this deliberately so her child can see that he can do it. Like, yeah. It's done with love.
At first, Lynette seems really, I don't know, hard, cold, a bit callous. But when she says, you know, like, we're not going to be around forever and you need to learn to do these things, you get it. That vulnerable side of her that's just looking out for him.
Yeah, it is a really heartbreaking scene because the camera shows Lynette. It doesn't show the kid making the sandwich. We don't see Patrick, but we hear Patrick struggling to do something. And we visually see Lynette struggle with not helping him do it.
That might also be because this is her imagination, so it's more about how she responds to things, which is clever.
Yeah, yeah.
If you want to give the writers that much credit.
Probably not, but no, I'm kidding. But so she's like literally gripping the side because she wants to help him. She can hear him struggle. It's her natural predisposition to help her child when he is struggling, but she knows full well that she shouldn't because he has to learn to do it. He is successful at making the sandwich in the end. I mean, I've seen better sandwiches, but that's his first one.
Yeah.
It takes practice.
She says it looks good.
It did look good.
And then the smile exchange.
Yeah, everyone's happy in the end.
Lovely.
It was a lovely scene. Difficult to watch, but lovely in the end. We then flash forward to Patrick's graduation day, and he's graduating from law school and giving a speech about how he has overcome the odds given by his doctors and look where he is now. And we see a glimpse of Tom and Lynette, but they aren't sitting together.
Also, he's given a speech which implies that he did really well, because not everyone gives a speech.
No, I'm assuming he's valedictorian.
Yeah, so great.
Yeah, and awesome. Law school as well. Because there was the sign in the back, which...
And I'm assuming it was adult Penny in between them?
It's either Penny sitting between them or some young model that he's traded Lynette in for. So he does his speech. It's lovely. He thanks his mum. It was a very beautiful speech.
Also, older Lynette looks a lot more realistic than older Gabby.
Oh, yeah. Older Gabby looks like...
But then again, Gabby's imagination was wild.
Older... Yeah, but that's what happened with my imagination and yours. Like, your imagination will see older you as realistic. My imagination will see a decrepit old crone.
So realistic.
How dare you?
Anyway.
So, we then come back to present day, and Lynette wakes up from surgery to the news that they lost the child, but the other baby is fine. Lynette cries, and we cut to some time later, and Lynette is sitting there peacefully, and Gabby comes in, and they make up, and Gabby thanks Lynette and apologises, and Lynette tells her that they were going to name him Patrick, and he would have been amazing. And I'm crying again.
Yeah, I mean, Tom and Lynette and Gabby's acting here was really good, as per.
Yeah, like, it was such a wonderful way for Gabby and Lynette to make up. Gabby has already lost a child. She knows how it feels. Gabby's probably feeling quite
grateful, but also quite awful.
Yeah, she probably feels a level of guilt because Lynette lost her child in the aftermath of saving Gabby's. So Gabby's probably feeling an awful lot. I think all three of them.
Yeah, that's a lot to handle for Gabby.
So bloody fantastic in this episode.
And now I don't have to watch this episode ever again and feel all of my feelings.
Yeah. So yeah, and then Lynette announces that his name is going to be Patrick.
Yeah.
Or it would have been Patrick.
Which is interesting because Patrick Logan is introduced as a name in this episode as well.
It is introduced as a name.
Just a weird little thing. Nothing really worth noting, but just thought I'd mention it.
Maybe the writers couldn't think of any more P names.
Yeah, I mean, what other names are there?
Patrick.
You've taken them all. Porter, Parker, Preston.
Yeah.
Patrick. That's all of them.
Penelope.
Philip.
Oh, Philip's a good one, but it doesn't begin with P.
What about Palestine?
So we end the episode at the funeral of Carl Meyer, and we watch everyone grieve, and we see Susan and Julie, and Bree is sat alone in the back, and all the women are determined to keep on living the best way they know how. And no offense, but poor old MJ looks so bored
funeral.
Like, show some fucking respect, kid.
We're so in sync. I read that as well.
I saw MJ and I was like, MJ, I know he's not your dad, but
obviously
come on.
My eyes are first drawn to that row of people because they're at the front. Susan and Julie don't actually look that sad. Well, not as sad as you'd really expect.
I would have expected Julie to look sad.
Yeah.
Not so much Susan, maybe.
But rest in peace, Carl. Such a good addition to the show.
He really was so much fun. But again, as I said in the end of the last episode, it really feels like it was here just to tie up loose ends that they felt they would back themselves into a corner with. Like, yeah. Okay, Gabby and Lynette have made up now. That whole storyline's now. Now, we've signed that off. That was very easily done. Lynette saved Celia. Done. There we go.
They probably thought, how realistic, like, feasibly, how can we have Brie with Carl in the long run?
Yeah, exactly.
Can we even do that?
Oh, it was good having Brie and Carl together, but in the long term, it's not going to work out.
But I just really liked Carl on screen. He was a smarmy, disgusting, nasty, wretched character.
But also...
I loved it.
A fantastic dad.
He was a fantastic daddy.
not that kind of dad. He really cared about Julie.
Yeah.
But I would still pick older Carlos.
Well, yeah.
From this episode.
Yeah. Oh, R.I.P. Carl. We'll miss you on your smarmy ways.
So rest in peace to Carl, Mona, and Patrick.
Yeah.
From this episode.
Also the Bixes. Short-lived.
Yeah, they didn't really die this episode, though.
No, but it was discovered that they did die.
Yeah.
That was the end of the episode. Let's move on to our next segment where Joel's going to give us the gayest and the straightest moments, starting with the gayest moment.
So my award for gayest moment... it goes to Bree, who's sitting at the back of the funeral for Carl, all dressed in black, looking fierce. Now, every gay person in the world just wants to attend a funeral as like the mysterious stranger in the back.
Right.
Every gay person wants that. Don't deny it. If you're out there and you're gay and you're listening to this, don't deny it. We all love the drama. We love the whole drama of just standing at the back, maybe with just a black umbrella in the rain.
Okay.
I also had nothing, so I had to pick one out of my arse just then.
I really thought it was going to be Gabby.
For what?
Everything, stage mom.
Well, yeah, but...
And then, do you have the straightest moment?
You thought that was weird. My award for straightest moment... My award for straightest moment goes to Tom for picking Brandy as his song of choice to sing to Patrick.
Brandy.
And the sailor says, Brandy, you're a fine girl.
Oh, yeah, I don't know that song.
What a good wife you would be.
Yeah, dads being dads are very... It's a very straight thing.
It is a very straight thing. Just of all the songs in the world to sing to a crying kid, you sing Brandy.
Not a lullaby.
No.
Absolutely not.
Oh, Tom's there like, he loves it when I sing. I'm the sailor of Brandy.
Yeah. Oh, Tom, bless you.
And now we move on to Bee's Awards for Best and Worst Parent. So who do you have for the best parent?
My award for...
Best Parent of the Episode.
My award for best parent goes to Gabby, who comes to the conclusion after a nightmare that her daughter doesn't need to do anything to be special to her.
Fair enough.
Because that was a lovely sentiment.
That was a lovely sentiment. Well, good job, Gabby. Who do you have for the worst?
I don't.
You don't have a worst parent?
There wasn't really anyone to give it to because any semblance of parenting outside of what Gabby did was all in imagination land.
Yeah, but you still could give it to someone in imagination land.
No, because it wouldn't be fair.
Why not?
Because it's not real.
I gave mine to Tom in Imagination Land. It's not real.
Yeah, but you're you.
Yeah.
You do things that are weird. So that was the end of the episode. That was season 6, episode 11, If. Now, if anyone has any questions, queries, comments or theories, where can they find us?
You can find us on Instagram at boyfriendsreview, and you can find us on Twitter at BFSreview.
We've also got email, which is boyfriendsreview@outlook.com, and the artwork is done by our friend Louis, who you can find on Instagram at docredmonkdesign, and there's a link to his Etsy page, and you can leave us a review on anywhere where you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts being the primary one. And we will be back next time with season 6, episode 12, You Gotta Get a Gimmick.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, see you then.
See you then, guys.
Bye.
Bye.